Hello and welcome to Geek Warning. This episode is actually just me, Dave Rome, as Kaylee and Ronan are away in Belgium.
Wait, hold on, Dave. Sorry, I'm late. I arrived a little late. Wait, what'd I miss?
Whoa, James. Hey.
Hi, Dave.
Who's that next to you?
This is Zach. From Boulder Gruppetto.
Zach. How's it going? Boulder Gruppetto. Zach Edwards. Hello. Is this your first podcast?
It is.
Oh,
I think.
Welcome. Welcome to Geek Warning.
I had to argue with his boss a little bit. I did have to get him to, you know, take a break from his sweeping and taking out the garbage duties. I mean, he is just kind of a junior intern mechanic here.
Okay. But
sure. I did carve out a few minutes of his time.
I guess then we do have a team. It's not just me.
We do. This feels oddly familiar, Dave.
Mm. James, what do we have on for today?
We've got a whole bunch of tech news to discuss today, including a bunch of new road and gravel bikes. We've got a new carbon factory from Time Bicycles. We've got an intriguing development from our friends at Classified and some rather unfortunate and troubling news from Giro and Bell. Dave, I don't know if you're prepared. We may or may not have a Dirty Dirty Dave to discuss and maybe a PSA. We'll see. I should warn everyone listening to this show, however, that we are not today going to discuss, we're not going to do a super geeky deep dive on the Flanders pits, however, because Ronan's already put out a couple of really nerdy galleries from Belgium that are now up on escapecollective.cc, so you should go and check those out right now. More importantly, please sign up as a member for the Escape Collective, since we are a member-driven and funded publication, and as it turns out, it is your dollars / euros or pounds or whatever currency you use, which is how we pay for everything here. Dave, what do members get when they sign up for Escape Collective?
Well, first and foremost, you're supporting independent journalism.
Because this is how we get paid.
This exactly. I mean, yeah, I'd like to think we're professionals at what we do, but this is our profession to give an independent voice to the bicycle industry and to give honest opinions based on experience on the products that we handle and to make sure that people aren't wasting their money on products that aren't worth owning. But yeah, beyond that, there's a whole community behind Escape Collective. So your membership also gets you access to our Discord channel and the thousands of people there that are very busy, actually, discussing all forms of cycling and not cycling. You also get access on the site to our comments. So that is another thing that gets you behind the paywall along with the content. So
Members also get access to our not infrequent live podcast recording sessions. We're going to do a live tech podcast next week, actually.
Yeah, so I think the Ask a Wrench segment is going to be a sort of a live Q&A moving forward, which is quite fun.
We're going to need a jingle for Ask a Wrench.
Mm.
We'll work on that.
Yeah. Yeah, I've got some ideas there. That could be quite fun.
Okay, well, with that shameless self-promotion out of the way, shall we get into the news?
Sure.
All right. Well, first and foremost, Dave, I'm going to hand this one over to you. Rocky Mountain has a new gravel bike. Actually, it has a family of new gravel bikes. What are we looking at here?
Yeah, so Rocky Mountain, a Canadian brand, best really known for their mountain bikes. I mean, they're one of the more hardcore mountain bike brands in the world. They've been around for a long time as well, to the point that their website is just bikes.com, which I love.
Brilliant. And so good.
Yeah. They have gotten into gravel. So like they've got a new gravel bike called the Solo. And in many ways, it looks like just a very sensible gravel bike. There's nothing truly revolutionary here, but it does tick a lot of boxes. So there's room for 700 by 50 mil tires. There you can run two chain rings on the front of it. There's lots of mounts, as you'd expect. It's using that new SRAM UDH hanger, so you could fit that new transmission stuff on it if you so please, but it, you know, at the same time you can fit any other drivetrain on it. And then geometry-wise, it's like what you'd expect of a mountain bike company. It's got that slightly longer front center, designed to be used with a shorter stem. Head angle's not super slack on it. It's like around that 70 to 71 degree from memory, depending on the size. But yeah, overall, I'd say it's a pretty good first effort.
Well, although to be clear, this is not Rocky Mountain's first gravel bike. It's the first time they've done a carbon gravel bike, so they are kind of expanding their range here.
Yep.
But I do think it says a lot about where Rocky Mountain thinks gravel is going to be, or I guess it's probably a good bit of confirmation that even a company like Rocky Mountain thinks that gravel is here to stay.
Yep. And is relevant to their current customers as well, right? Like that there's enough mountain bikers taking up into gravel now that they've really invested in the segment. So yeah, I mean it's not their first gravel bike, but in my mind it was, because I guess they almost weren't relevant to me in the gravel space before that. I really did see them as a mountain bike brand. But yeah, they've this new Solo carbon bike start from $3,800 US, and alloy version start from $1,700. So yeah, it's not it's in the affordable space, which is cool to see.
Yeah, and I think I don't know. My guess is that just knowing what we already know about how much crossover there is between particularly like cross country / trail categories of mountain biking and gravel, it makes sense. I think that Rocky Mountain would kind of expand their gravel offerings, or kind of like dive deeper into there.
Absolutely. And yeah, I mean, that's not an isolated incident, right? Like that, we've seen that from other, what you'd deem hardcore mountain bike brands, like Evil comes to mind with the Chamois Hager, and Santa Cruz, for example. They've also long had a gravel bike. So, I mean, it's definitely this trend of mountain bike brands playing in the drop bar space from a different perspective.
I think too, like not necessarily just trying to go after mountain bikers and sell them gravel bikes. I think there are a lot of bike shops that are not a Trek or a Specialized or a Giant dealer, that Rocky Mountain is one of their brands, and they have like, I don't know, 5 or 10 small brands, but that just is another bike option that they have to sell rather than just being like, oh, well, they only make mountain bikes.
Yep. So. And it's a gateway, right? Like if you imagine that a lot of road riders are finding gravel and enjoying the off-road segment there, and then are getting into mountain biking, it makes sense for these mountain bike brands to put themselves out there to that market as well, to introduce themselves to customers at that touch point. So yeah, I mean, like Rafa's a very good example of how they've managed that, right? Like they've got a very large customer base of hardcore road cyclists, but as they find themselves into gravel or even mountain bike, I mean, Rafa now has that product to keep them dressed. So it's... I think it's quite interesting to see just these brands playing in segments we don't associate them with, and I'm all for it.
I mean, yeah, and I guess just one last point before we move on. I think again, it is sort of a reminder that although we already know that people who ride bikes, I mean, there is a tendency for people to kind of dabble in multiple sports to some extent, but I think it's far more likely that you have cyclists dabbling in other categories of cycling as opposed to other sports altogether.
Yep.
So I mean, like all three of us here, we all ride pretty much everything. And whereas there certainly are people who only ride road or only ride mountain, so on and so forth, there's an awful lot of people who ride a lot of different bikes. So this is a good reminder of that. Dave, this Rocky Mountains, I mean, sounds maybe not extraordinary, but it still sounds kind of interesting. I don't know. Should we get one in?
I would like to. I would definitely like to. So yeah, let's, at this point, assuming they're willing to put one in a box for us, let's say we'll have a review on one shortly.
Well, I guess we'll have to see if they'll ship one out to Sydney. Anyway, moving on, what else do we have in the gravel bike space?
There is a new gravel bike. Cannondale have a new fancy one, the Lab 71 Topstone. James, I'll let you explain what this one is.
So the Topstone Carbon has been around for a few years now, maybe like 3, I think, maybe. But Cannondale did redesign it last year, almost a year ago exactly, now that I think about it. And they kept a whole bunch of the stuff, basically everything that I really liked about the first generation one. But they got rid of all the goofy proprietary stuff that really no one was super excited about. So they got rid of the asymmetrical rear end. They got rid of the custom offset crankset. They got rid of the super wide bottom bracket. And instead they went to basically a symmetrical setup as far as where everything's oriented. It's a standard 142mm through axle in the back, regular offset crankset with a regular threaded 68mm English bottom bracket.
Wow, what a novelty.
Tire clearance has actually gone up too. It used to be 700 by 42, and now it's 700 by 45. And then the way they did all this was basically how a lot of other companies were getting to this point with their carbon gravel bikes is they dropped the drive side chainstay. So chainstay length is up just a little bit, but that's fine. It's not a big deal. But the big thing with the Lab 71 version, it's the same mold, as far as I can tell, as the regular Topstone Carbon, but it uses a fancier carbon layup, and now it's 160 grams lighter. And that should bring the claimed frame weight to, I think, just below the 1,000-gram mark, which for a gravel bike is pretty good, especially one that has that kind of like 30 mils of pseudo suspension that it has in the back.
So 160 grams lighter, but how much more expensive?
It's not cheap. I don't remember what the a Topstone Carbon regular gravel frame set costs.
Yeah.
The Lab 71 version, however, is $4,500 US. It's a lot of money.
But the paint on that alone looks like it's worth $1,000.
Easily, if not more.
This is a bike that confuses me. Because the person that generally buys a Topstone is more in the adventure-y segment of gravel. But this one is essentially the same as that. It's just lighter. And usually the people that buy lighter bikes are people that are racing gravel. So if you're racing, why would I want this bike over the Super 6 Evo SE?
Well, I think what's weird about the Topstone, though, is it does have a decent amount of mounts. Like this bike, even though it's supposed to be a super light gravel bike, it does still have like 3-pack mounts on the fork blades. The geometry is still kind of unusual for a gravel bike. Like it doesn't run that much bottom bracket drop. It's like 65 millimeters, I think. And then the trail dimension is pretty short and it has a pretty long front end. So like the handling is actually pretty sporty. So it's an interesting bike. Like it almost seems like a kind of go fast gravel bike, but it can also carry stuff. It is a little bit of a head scratcher in what it's sort of trying to be like. I guess it's a head scratcher in the sense that while everyone else is trying to be like super specific with their gravel models, this one is just sort of seemingly like a good all-around carbon gravel bike.
I think for me it kind of fits into that like ultra rough gravel race space, like the adventure race, I guess, which is like kind of the same space where like the Lauf Siegler is almost playing in, but this one doesn't have as much tire clearance, which I guess is where it's slightly peculiar. Is it you got like these comfort features, they sell it with front suspension in some cases. But at the same time, it's like, yeah, you're limited to a 45 mil tire. So I kind of agree with Zach on that one, which is, it is a bit of an odd one, which is, yeah, why would you pick this over their even racier version?
Yeah. And I think like the normal Topstone, right? Like I can see that customer. That's like, you just want a gravel bike that does gravel bike things, but why spend the extra money to get one that's 150 grams lighter?
160 grams.
Sorry, 160 exact. Grams.
160.
Like it just better. Is like, but like that person for the Topstone doesn't necessarily like that. To me, it's like the bike and the customer aren't the same thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I know like gravel, there's like a wide range of spectrum of things and what people do with the bikes, but it's just a very interesting one for me as like they have the Super 6 gravel bike already.
Yeah. I think unfortunately this is a case of bike industry doing bike industry things, and it's probably not about the 160 grams weight saved. It's about a special paint and the fact that it's more expensive. Yeah.
Right.
Right. Like it's just merely like a, I don't know. It's like an S-Works version of the Diverge is what I'm going to liken it to.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, same thing. And plenty of people buy those, I guess.
So. Yeah. Yeah. So it's unfortunately, it's not a performance purpose, dare I say.
I do find it interesting though. Like it seems like I'm maybe speculating. They came out the Lab 71 road bike, and now this is a Lab 71 gravel bike. It'll be interesting to see what's next and what changes, if any, are made. Like the Super 6 gravel bike, I could see that gaining internal cable routing, and being lighter, like an even racier version of that. And then, I mean, mountain bikes will be interesting as well.
So my understanding with the Lab 71 series is that it's dedicated to bikes that they deem worthy of racing. But most importantly, and looking at the current two Lab 71 bikes that they've got, the Super 6 and the Super 6 and the now Topstone, they do seem to be reusing molds. So I don't think they're going to be using Lab 71 to add features that differentiated anything more than like weight and paint.
Right.
So yeah, I think it's moving forward that as they release new models, yeah, they'll be Lab 71 versions with like really fancy spec and really fancy paint and a little bit lighter layup. But I don't think we'll see them separate with like, you know, entirely different front end features or different frame sets.
Right.
And it does also bring up the question of, you know, Cannondale had said earlier at the intro of the whole Lab 71 thing, Dave, kind of like you mentioned, like the whole concept around Lab 71 is supposed to be making kind of like the best race bikes that they can.
Yeah.
And so it's not really supposed to be like ultra boutique parts. And I mean, the parts are obviously expensive, but they're all supposed to be parts that supposedly improve the performance of the bike and help people go faster on them. Like, that's the whole idea of it.
Does paint make people go faster?
Less paint, theoretically.
Weighs less.
Yeah. But at least as far as gravel goes, it does bring up the question, and I think we've discussed this before, you and I certainly over the years and whatnot. It does bring up the question of what exactly constitutes fast on gravel. Mm-hmm. Just because there is such a wide range of what gravel is for different people, like if it's kind of rough or it's kind of smooth or whatever. And I mean, Zach, obviously you and I around here, our gravel is, I mean,
it's road bikeable.
We could use the stereotypical term of champagne gravel, because it can be really smooth. But at the same time, when you head out on some more traily stuff, some more single tracky stuff, I mean, I know certainly experience on mountain bikes tells me the same thing, that when you have a bike that rides smoother, you can go faster. So if you are in a situation where a lot of your gravel ride does constitute terrain that's even just a little bit bumpier, I don't see the downside of having a smoother ride like what you'd get on the back end of something like this versus something that is lighter and or more aero or whatever. So I think it's sort of just horses for courses and that sort of thing.
Yep, for sure.
Anyway, I'm intrigued. Cannondale's only selling this as a frame set. Like you said, it's $4,500 US. I kind of wonder, like Ronan's been playing with the idea of an aero gravel bike. Like he built up a, I think, was it a Damani or a Checkpoint that he built up with super
might
deep
say
wheels?
It's a Damani.
Yeah, it's but the previous gen, I think.
Okay.
If I remember.
So he's building up sort of like a mild gravel bike, like kind of like crazy aero. I kind of wonder how stupidly light you could go with a gravel bike that's still capable.
Mm. Yeah, it's. I think it's a category where you quickly run into reliability issues as soon as you actually get a light bike.
Well,
it's an interesting concept.
Anyway, fun one to think about. Maybe we'll toss this around too. Moving on, moving away from the gravel space and onto road bikes, we do have a new titanium flagship road model from Lightspeed called the Spezia. Spezia, I think. S-P-E-Z-I-A. It is kind of what you'd expect from Lightspeed. There's an awful lot of shaping going on here. It's a mix of 325 and 6.4 titanium tubing. There's hardly anything round on it at all, aside from like the bottom bracket shell and head tube, I think. The top tube's like super rectangular. The down tube, they say, is actually kind of arrow-ish because it's sort of triangular shaped, sort of. It is impressively light, all things considered. Its claimed weight is 1,120 grams for a medium frame, which is pretty good for titanium. Mm. Tire clearance is really good, 35 mils. Got an optional T47 bottom bracket. You have, you know, the usual light speed stuff like in-house machine dropouts and fittings. You got a range of anodized finish choices. It looks pretty nice. It is expensive, as you'd expect, but it's not outrageously so, I don't think, all things considered, of course.
That pricing doesn't look that bad to me.
It's like I said, all things considered, it's not that bad. Like, it's welded in the US. It's 8,000 US for a complete Altegra DI2 bike, or 12,500 US with Shimano DuraAce and Zip 303s. Lightspeed hasn't announced that they're going to do it as a frame only, but I'd imagine that they will, and that price is still to be determined. But this one, honestly, I think looks pretty sweet. I mean, at least on paper, I would definitely bring one of these in.
Yeah, and like stock geometry, I assume. It's not custom geometry.
I mean, I don't think, as we're recording this, this frame is actually under embargo.
Oh.
Quote unquote embargo. But by the time people are listening to this thing, it will be live. So based on what Lightspeed has offered with its other higher end models, I would imagine custom geometry is going to be available, along with other like little custom bits. If you want like fender mounts and stuff like that, I'd imagine they'll be able to supply all that. But I kind of like the idea of a higher end titanium bike. And I like that companies are still pushing the titanium thing and kind of like, you know, not just going after the sort of craftsmanship thing and also kind of like pushing the technology of the stuff.
James, I'm going to throw you under a giant bus of speculation here, but what is it about light speed that often allows them to lower the expected weight of titanium frames versus just about everyone else? Are they just underbuilding these? Or are they, you know, how are they reducing the weight compared to the normal 1400-ish, 1500-ish gram point that you normally see for titanium?
I mean, Lightspeed didn't point this out explicitly as far as the weight savings go. But one thing that they did point out is with that rectangular top tube, they are forming that out of flat 6-4 sheet. And if they are doing that out of pretty thin 6-4 sheet, it could be pretty light. It's all internally butted and that sort of thing. So the tube sections are, the tube walls are pretty thin. Mm. You know, how much that might play into the long-term durability of the thing, I don't know, because certainly as wall thicknesses get thinner, you are more prone to denting and that sort of thing. So I don't know. It kind of remains to be seen. But you know, my guess is that durability is going to take a hit to some extent. I don't know how much. Titanium stuff does seem to still last long, or at least hold up better long term than a lot of composite stuff. Mm. And my guess is that the bike probably is going to ride awesome, but we'll see.
Yeah. Zach, have you built many bikes from Lightspeed? I know you have your hands on other titanium bikes on the regular, but...
I have built some Lightspeeds, I think from the current iteration of Lightspeed, the brand. I did run into some QC issues.
Okay. Good to know.
But otherwise, they seem fine.
Yeah.
I mean, definitely more mass-produced, I would say. Like, sure. The welds aren't quite as nice as... like some of the smaller, more boutique-y brands. Mm-hmm. But I'd say I'm still a fan of this. It sounds sweet. Titanium road bike with tire clearance for 35s. Like,
yeah.
I mean, I would say it's been winter here, so I've not ridden road bikes. And I was just on holiday where it was much warmer. And I took my road bike, which is titanium, and I hadn't ridden it in, I don't know, 4 or 5 months. And I forgot how lovely they ride. It was great. And I could travel with it, and I don't have to worry about it getting dented or broken or anything.
What, the paint getting scratched?
Paint getting scratched, none of it. It's great.
Yeah. And it costs roughly comparable to a Trek.
Well, maybe Zach's was a little bit more. He does have a custom mosaic.
Oh, okay.
It's rim brakes, though, so it's cheaper.
I meant the Lightspeed, but yeah.
Yeah, so anyway, I am pretty excited to get my hands on one of these. I actually have already put in a request for a test bike. And yeah, I'm pretty excited to check this one out. So like you said, Dave, the pricing is, all things considered, pretty good.
Yeah, it was like $8,000 for an Altegra bike.
Yeah.
Like, that's great. Like, that is a good alternative to mainstream brands, I think.
I agree. And yeah, they're not doing any super weird cable riding up front. Like, it's not fully internal, thank God. Like, it ticks a lot of boxes for me, at least anyway, for a bike that I would be looking to buy to hold on to long term.
Yeah, for sure. All right, I'm intrigued by that one.
Okay. Also intriguing, moving on, sticking to the primarily road bike space here. I think most people listening to this podcast will be familiar with the brand name Time, and we're talking about Time as in frames, not pedals, although for not too long ago, it was the same company. Time actually recently changed hands, the frame company, actually, and the pedal company, but... Time Bicycle has recently changed hands. It's now under ownership, I guess, led by Tony Karklins, who was also running Orbea USA for God knows how long, and he also founded Allied in the US. And Time just opened up they're about to open up a massive factory in South Carolina in the US dedicated to carbon frame production. So this is from their press release, quote, "Through our collaboration with Clemson University, Krauss, Maffei, and the SC Fraunhofer USA Alliance, we look to advance Time's proprietary RTM technologies to produce the most advanced carbon fiber bicycles in the industry." They also talk about how they're going to, I guess, scale up production quite a bit, or at least they're hoping to, depending on how many bikes they sell. But Time obviously has pretty big plans or aspirations for expansion, and I think it's interesting for a couple of reasons. One, that it is going to be bikes that are manufactured in the U.S., but also because it...
French bikes manufactured in the U.S.
I mean, yeah, sorry, I mean, it's French history, but I mean, even Time's factory in Europe now is in Slovenia, or is it Slovakia? Yeah. I always forget.
They're still very French bikes, though.
They are still very French. But I guess the big thing with this is that Time is one of very, very few carbon bike manufacturers that continues to use resin transfer molding as a manufacturing process. So like if you go to the Time website, like I think right away you have this video auto playing in front of you that shows like their big carbon fiber braiding machines and stuff like that. So the way that they put the carbon together is very different. It's almost kind of like a, it's almost kind of like a sock.
Right. That they'd make hard.
But the way then that they do all that, all that stuff is like all those fibers are woven dry and then put in the mold. And then the resin is essentially injected through all that carbon material. And it's a very different way of doing it. It's actually a very common way to do it in the automotive world right now for any of those parts that are made using carbon fiber. And the big advantage of that is, I mean, one, people who are proponents of RTM say that you get fewer voids and fewer defects and that sort of thing. But from a production standpoint, what's nice is that you don't have to refrigerate the carbon fiber since it's not pre-impregnated with resin.
It's also more automated.
It is for sure. So
rather than hand-laying pre-preg carbon.
So I don't know exactly what this factory is going to look like inside, and Time didn't really talk a whole lot about it, but I'm kind of imagining like a bunch of robots and stuff.
Mm. It's pretty, I mean, like, yeah, the old Time factory was just a crazy number of spools that kind of look like a cotton weaving factory.
Yeah.
Which is carbon running everywhere, but strands of carbon running everywhere. But this factory sounds pretty big. It's what, 140,000 square foot? That's large.
Yeah, 140,000 square feet, sits on 30 acres of land. I don't know what that is in square meters. But it's a big facility for sure.
Yeah, wow. And should probably worth mentioning that, yeah, it's in South Carolina, which from my understanding is they've got quite a few grants that have allowed this to happen. So sort of encouraging local manufacturing, which is done in many states across the US, but it's not something you normally associate with the bike industry. So it's kind of cool to see that sort of investment being made.
Yeah, I like seeing Time sort of enjoying a bit of a resurgence right now. I'm certainly old enough to remember kind of the glory days of Time, I guess I could say. I've never ridden a Time, but anyone I know who has owned one or has spent a whole lot of time one, they always talk about the kind of like the ride quality more than anything else. I don't know. They seem pretty neat. I'm optimistic to see what they come up with moving forward.
I hope the new factory maintains the same level of quality frames. Like that's where the issue I see here is like the previous times you pull the fork out and look inside the frame and they're just completely flawless. Where like the guy, I can't remember what his name is. I think Tony or something you said, coming from Allied. And I would say Allied frames, in my experience, the QC is not quite there when you look inside the frames. So I hope that they can continue that level of quality at Time while maintaining some Frenchness.
What sort of Frenchness are you hoping to maintain here?
I don't, just like quirky, weird things.
Like,
because,
like down tube storage for a baguette?
Yeah, exactly.
That would actually be kind of cool. All right. Well, we'll keep an eye on this one. I don't know exactly when Time is saying that they are going to like actually be producing frames out of this facility, but it sounds like they're going to be moving pretty quick on this one. So I suspect we'll find out sooner than later. Zach, you had mentioned the head scratcher thing earlier with the Topstone Lab 71, and this next piece of news is definitely
very head scratching.
Most people listening to this podcast, I suspect, will have heard by now of that company Classified, the company that's doing those 2-speed rear hubs. Dave, I know you have a fair bit of experience with the road going version of that, and I've played around with it a little bit, and they are really cool. Just how quickly they shift between their two gears, they're pretty reasonably light, and so on and so forth. But now Classified has come out with a 2-speed mountain bike hub. They're saying that it's a 46% ratio change between the two gears, roughly equivalent to like 2 to 3 conventional rear shifts on a wide range cassette. Now, they're saying that it can do that shift in 150 milliseconds, which is pretty quick. And they're saying the system can also do that under a pedaling load of up to 1,000 watts. And Classified is intending for that rear hub to be paired with its own 1140 12-speed cassette. And they're saying the total range is 530%, which is just a hair bigger than SRAM Eagle stuff right now. Then you still have a wireless shifter. It's like a ring-shaped thing that goes on the left side of the bar.
Yeah, looks a lot like they've borrowed some inspiration from a company called Zerbel, who do a similar ring shifter on the mountain bike side.
Exactly.
Cool.
It's not quite as expensive as I thought it would be. It's 2,700 euros for a complete carbon wheel set with the hub and the shifter. So not cheap, but considering you get some carbon wheels with it, it's not as bad as I thought it might be. But I mean, yeah, scratching heads here. And we've spent all this time in the last few years ditching front derailleurs and multiple chain rings on mountain bikes. And when that happened, there were all the usual arguments of like, oh, like the gaps between the gears are going to be too big and all these other things. And now one by is obviously the norm for mountain bikes. And Classified is almost seeming to like rewind the clock a little bit by claiming that now you can get a little bit more range, but still have tighter gears between individual gear shifts at back. But I guess one thing that they're saying is, like, if you suddenly hit a climb, or like, you know, you're suddenly going down the other side or whatnot, shifting in the rear, they're saying, is a lot faster than trying to do two or three conventional shifts out back. This still feels weird. Like the Classified two-speed road hub, I think still makes sense. But I don't know if I'm seeing the merits of this one.
Yeah, I feel like it's one of those like solving a problem that the problem doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I mean the tighter ratios is probably the main benefit here. Whereas if say you got, for example, Eagle 10 to 52 tooth cassette, each jump between each shift is actually quite large, which for me personally, off-road is actually what you want. You want a noticeable jump. You don't want to have to feel like you need to shift 2 to 3 gears every time you need to make a gear change. On the road though, I guess these tighter jumps could be beneficial. For me, the biggest question I have is, it comes down to, I guess, almost the weight of the system. This is actually kind of adding weight back into the bike, not taking it away. And for me, I would want, if you're going to lose that massive, say, 10 to 52 tooth cassette, I'd want it to come with a weight saving that, you know, becomes unsprung weight and makes your suspension work better and all that. But actually, this is adding weight, and it's actually almost heavier. It's a few grams heavier than like a SRAM GX system, but then it's significantly heavier than, say, XO or XX1 or XTR And that's the sort of level that you'd assume that person's running if they're willing to spend 2,700 euro on this system with wheels.
And I think like what's interesting to me is the only people I've ever heard really complain about the big wide range mountain bike cassettes that we have now are the people that live where it's flat. And they're like, I don't need this much range. So whether they'll run either older stuff where it's a smaller cassette or like running a Force Explorer derailleur and cassette to kind of have a tighter range. And like those are the only people I know of that have complained about that. And those people also don't need essentially what is a front derailleur. So just like it just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, the bigger issue for me is that I thought when I heard months ago that Classified working on a mountain bike system, I thought in my mind that this could be quite cool. This could be a narrow range cassette, which is significantly lighter. And then that narrow range cassette could be used with a much smaller rear derailleur, which then has added clearance. It's less likely to get caught up by sticks. It's less weight on the rear end. It could actually be beneficial to mountain bikes. But this is still using the same rear derailleur that you probably have on the bike currently.
But what derailleur would they use otherwise? Like they'd have to make their own rear derailleur.
Their own. Which they haven't done. I'm not to say they won't do it. I mean, they've denied that they will at this point. But I mean, for me, that makes logical sense that they would eventually do that. But I think what's even more curious to me is that modern derailleurs, you look at SRAM, that derailleur is specifically designed for that cassette range that they offer, that 10 to 52 tooth. Like the parallelogram is basically locked into that cassette ratio. And it's odd to me that the shifting would be as good with an 11 to 40 tooth cassette, which is very different to a 10 to 52 tooth cassette. So I think there'd probably be a shifting compromise here. I haven't used it, but I'm speculating that that B gap, the gap between the upper pulley wheel and the cog, is going to be pretty substantial, and that's going to cause some pretty slow shifting.
I mean, probably the best option would be to use the like XTR. They make a shorter cage version of the rear derailleur for meant for a 1045, and that's going to be the closest, I would think.
Yeah, and that's even stranger because I asked Classified, like, what rear derailleur do you recommend with this system? And their response was SRAM and TRP rear derailleurs will work best. They didn't mention Shimano, which just, interesting. I don't know. That's very strange to me. I don't know whether that's like maybe there's something weird going on there from a relationship point of view between them and Shimano.
I mean, right, because it could be the chain too. Function. Like Shimano has the Hyperglide Plus, and but then SRAM has their own, and then TRP also uses a KMC chain. So it's interesting that you'd have one cassette that seemingly works with all three.
Yep. So yeah. Anyway,
head scratcher.
I think there's a lot of questions that I have from this system. But at the same time, while I, as James said, like we're quite sold on the idea of this on a road or a gravel bike, like it makes sense there and it has benefit there. And I will be reviewing a system soon. But for the mountain bike, I'm left wondering why.
Here's what I was kind of hoping for from Classified when they had, like you, Dave, like when they mentioned that they were working on mountain bike stuff, I got pretty excited at what could be. Because to provide some background, the people who designed the hub, they came from the automotive transmission world. And for anyone listening, please feel free to correct me if I'm wrong here. But my understanding is that the way the Classified hub operates, it's very analogous to a dual clutch transmission in a car, which is one of the reasons why it works so fast and which is why it's a fair bit different than a lot of other gearbox systems out there. But what I was really hoping for from Classified is their own take on an internal gearbox sort of thing, like kind of like what you have from
with multiple gears, not just like a
two. Like sort of like the idea of like a roll off or a pinion or something like that, but with the shifting speed and with presumably the greater efficiency that you get with that Classified design. Because I feel like at that point, if you were able to get, you know, even like 8, 9 whatever gears out of something like that in a package that is ideally more efficient and lighter than what you get from roll-off and pinion, let's say they were able to pull that off, that I feel like is something that would actually move the needle as far as mountain bikes go. Because you do have these really kind of progressive designs like Zeroed, which I think are they out of New Zealand?
Yep.
So like you have bikes like that are built around gearbox drivetrains, and then in that way you are able to get some real performance benefits. And then if you're able to get that sort of frame design and suspension design out of a gearbox, but with a gearbox that's lighter and more efficient and shifts faster, particularly under load, then at that point, that's something that we can all get really excited about. Because as good as this new SRAM quote-unquote transmission supposedly is, it is still a conventional rear derailleur. And as good as it apparently works, I still am particularly more excited about the idea of gearboxes. And I'm really excited about this super drive thing from, is it LAL? L-A-L?
Yeah.
I think they're they Canadian or French? I can't remember now.
French-Canadian.
French-Canadian, okay. But like that design, I feel like is also really interesting because it moves it basically takes sort of like half a derailleur and sticks it inside the rear triangle, so it's totally shielded from everything. I mean, that sort of wholesale redesign is something that I'm really excited about, and that's kind of what I was hoping to see from Classified. I mean, maybe this is sort of a stopgap, maybe that's still coming, but as it is right now, I'm not sure why someone would get this thing.
Yep. I could see it potentially being useful in like maybe a touring bike, but that same argument applied to their previous system as well. So this doesn't add anything new to that. I still need to put a Classified hub on a bike with a touring setup at the front and have double the gears. That's still something I need to play with. That'd be fun.
All right. Well, speaking of things that make more sense, Feedback Sports has a new repair stand, Dave. What are we looking at?
Yeah. So, I mean, last year they introduced their Pro Mechanic HD, which is like this overbuilt folding repair stand, which was designed to basically support everything, but including the heaviest of e-bikes. And it came with it was basically an entire redesign, a whole new model, but it came with a new clamp as well, which had more clamping capacity. It had some cool features like a quick spinner on the front of it. It has that quick release button that if you hit the side of it, it opens the jaws up. And yeah, it had, I guess, all of the knobs on it were much easier to use and had more leverage. And what they've done is they've taken a lot of those features and they've now introduced them to a stand just called the Pro Mechanic, which actually replaces their Pro Elite stand, which I guess anyone who's wrenched at races would have seen, or anyone who's actually attended a professional mountain bike or cyclocross race in the last 15 years would have seen this stand a lot, because it's the most commonly used work stand at those races. And yeah, it's Feedback Sports top end, lightweight, foldable, portable work stand has completely been revised. So yeah, it's predominantly the main feature update here is seen at the clamp and at the top half of the stand. The bottom half is pretty much the same as old, but just with a new feet. But yeah, it's an interesting one to me because the stand rocks, and I've still got an original Ultimate stand that is coming on 20 years old and is still great, and I can still fix it if I need to. And that's just a great product worth owning.
That Ultimate stand is actually the first thing I ever bought at discount when I first started working at a shop. And yeah. I really, really wish I still had it. I gave it to somebody because I somehow ended up with like a surplus of Ultimate, or not Ultimate, but I somehow ended up with basically a surplus of Feedback Sports repair stands because Feedback bought Ultimate, at least the bicycle portion of it anyway. And yeah, I wish I still had that thing because like it was awesome. And now I feel like it's a piece of history that I'll never get back. I think I might know who I gave it to. I can't remember now, but yeah, I got a little bummed.
My Ultimate stand has a bit of a story. I think it was my 15th birthday present that I requested. And at the time I was such a nerd that I was dealing with a bike shop in the US, Mountain High Cyclery, which I think is actually not too far from you, James.
I've never heard of it.
Okay. So Colorado shop, I think it was called Mountain High Cyclery. And I arranged that they would sell me the stand, but because it was such a bulky good, he ended up having a friend that was coming to Sydney, and that friend, who I can't remember the name of, unfortunately, was actually flew with it for me on the plane and just like handed it to me in person.
What?
Yeah. So I mean, that's the stand is well traveled and is still kicking.
I'm not sure what's more amazing here, the process that you went through to get this thing, or the fact that what you wanted for your 15th birthday was an Ultimate repair stand.
And what 15-year-old doesn't want one of those?
Yeah.
Clearly.
Right?
But better question, Dave. Did you end up getting like the full accessory package with the little hanging toolbox that went on there and the trimming stand and everything?
I got mine with the tote bag. And then at a later date, I bought the touring stand and the tool tray.
No, there was a toolbox that went on there.
I'd never got the toolbox, no.
I have the toolbox.
Mm.
We may have to arrange a swap.
But yeah, anyway, it's a solid product. Like I treat it like trash these days. It mostly sits outside and it actually still works just as well as it did all those years ago.
I mean,
I'm sold on this product.
My everyday stand is an old Feedback Sports stand, and this was from probably 15 years ago or so. They actually did a limited edition, like something like 20 stands total that had Rasta-colored legs, like the red, yellow, and green anodized legs. So I do have one of those. This is one I will absolutely never, ever get rid of. Because, yeah, I think they really did only make like 20 of them. I have no idea how I ended up with one of these, but I have one and it's amazing and it still works great.
I mean, I have one that's probably, I don't know, 10 plus years old at this point, and I use it to wash bikes every single day and it still is great.
Yeah. Yeah. So needless to say, it's a product that all of us rate highly, but this new model, yeah, has enough interesting new things that I've got one for review, and I'm actually going to do a comparison against it and the newest Park tool, which are pretty closely comparable these days. So I'm quite looking forward to getting stuck into that comparison.
Excellent. I think
there's going to be some interesting things from that.
Cool. When can we expect to see that?
When I finish it.
Yes, Dave.
Yeah.
All right, then. Well, with that very, very vague promise, I guess we'll move on. Our next bit of news, unfortunately, is definitely not super happy. I mean, Dave, this is unfortunately the sort of thing that you and I have an awful lot of experience with over the last few months. Giro and Bell, very well-known helmet and apparel and sort of accessory brands and stuff, their entire brand, creative, and marketing teams were just recently laid off very suddenly for both companies, and they were replaced by the staff at Fox Racing. That's the not Fox Suspension, Fox Racing, like the logo that you see with a little fox head on it. It's the apparel and protective brand that parent company Vista Outdoor bought this past August. So we've received word also that Vista is also planning to shut down the Giro and Bell facility in Scotts Valley, California. They've been there for God knows how long, but that facility is going to be shut down September 1st. And we've been told that any remaining staff have been asked to either commit to relocating 6.5 hours south to Irvine, Southern California, or resign. And this has all apparently come about without any cost of living adjustment as well, because it is quite a bit more expensive to live in Irvine than it is in Scotts Valley. This sounds real crappy. Definitely lots of talks of synergies and that sort of thing.
This makes me not want to buy Giro stuff anymore.
It's really a bummer, like a huge, huge bummer, because from my understanding, it's about 30 or 40 people who have just been sacked. All at once, all very suddenly. A lot of these people, like some of them were on holidays. Some of them were, I know one in particular was like, you know, they were often like photo shoots that were like, they were in the middle of like marketing projects that they were assigned to do. Sea Otter is coming up here in the US in just a couple weeks. And I've been told that they don't even know if they're going to be going to that at all. Giro and Bell always have like a huge booth space reserved at Sea Otter. So I would imagine at this point that's already paid for. So I don't know what they're going to do there. But this sounds like a huge mess, because essentially what Vista has done is just decided to consolidate all of those functions into the marketing and brand and creative people at Fox. And I can see
who probably don't want that job either.
Well, even if they don't, whether they do or don't want it, the thing is those people at Giro and Bell, they have spent, some of them haven't spent decades building sort of the identity and, you know, kind of image and kind of, I guess for lack of a better term, sort of the spirit of these brands. And I can totally understand how on paper it would make sense to consolidate those roles. Again, quote unquote synergies. But I have a hard time seeing this as anything other than a short-term gain, because like long-term, there's just so much lost there.
Yeah. It's very familiar for me.
How so, Dave?
Oh, no, nothing. No reason. It's just, I don't know. I might need to, yeah, I don't know. I'm sure if you gave me some time, I could sit outside and figure it out, but it just feels very familiar. But, I would say that, yeah, it's just shitty all around.
Yeah, and like the severance packages were pretty, I guess, odd. They were offered apparently a week for each year that they're employed. So for some people, that'll be pretty decent. For an awful lot of other people, it just won't be very good. And certainly here in the US, that's a much bigger deal, because generally speaking, like unless you have some sort of severance package set up from your now former employer, like you don't get a whole lot. I mean, you do get some unemployment and whatnot, but anyway, those protections aren't really awesome here. Either way, this is super, super crummy news. You know, we at Escape Collective, certainly like our hearts go out to everyone at Giro and Bell who has been laid off and let go. We also have a lot of personal connections there, and we know a bunch of people personally who have been let go. And yeah, we wish all of you the best of luck, because yeah, we know how that feels.
Yeah. Not to stay on this for too long, but like, what makes it all the more peculiar is that I'm hearing reports that the Giro and the Bell team are actually pretty profitable. Like they've been getting good numbers, and that unlike some other businesses currently who had seen massive declines, I mean they were still doing good things. So it just, yeah, as you say, James, it's just very short term thinking from what I can see.
Yeah, I mean I don't get it. I mean obviously, we are not privy to a whole lot of the sorts of decisions that companies like this would make. I'm sure someone decided that it would make a lot of sense, but who knows? All right. Last segment of the show. I'm curious, Dave.
Second last.
Oh, that's right. Second last. No, you're correct. What do you got on your mind, Dave, that might be over the heads of your family?
Electric inflators, which is weirdly on my mind a lot.
It doesn't seem weird to me at all,
because they're so
Dave.
Noisy when you do use them. But yeah, I'm back testing them again, and I've got my hands on the Fumpa Nano, which is this tiny little cube that is a little very cute air compressor. And the copy version of it, which is a Psych Plus, which is a Chinese copy, who have managed to carefully skirt around the patents of Fumpa and actually create a pretty good product. But yeah, I'm testing those. I'll have the review done pretty soon of those. But yeah, it's an interesting little battle of tiny little portable electric air items, which are designed to replace a mini pump or CO2 and be rechargeable, faster to use, no effort. And unlike CO2, if you accidentally have a leak at your valve, you don't end up wasting your cartridge. So they're interesting. That said, I think there will be a winner in the battle, but I think fundamentally I'll still continue to carry CO2 instead of one of these.
Are you only testing portable ones, or also testing like the mechanic ones?
Right now I'm only testing these tiny little handheld ones, which are like roughly around 100 grams each and probably the size of like a Tubolito tube, like even smaller than a regular butyl folded tube. So they're
little.
Very, very small. Very unique little product. But yeah, they like the Fumpa, for example, can inflate. Yesterday inflated a 28 mil 700C road tire twice to 80 PSI and then again to 55 PSI before it cut out, ran out of battery. So, I mean, they're pretty capable for the size. They pack a punch.
Huh. Okay, I'm intrigued. I'm looking forward to that one, Dave, I will honestly say.
Mm. Yeah. Mm. James, what's on your mind?
I've actually been thinking a lot about cable drivetrains lately, mainly because, I mean, I never used to think of myself as a Luddite, and I still don't think of myself as a Luddite necessarily, but, you know, people who know me reasonably well know that I have an affinity for cable drivetrains. Just maybe it's from old school mechanic days or whatnot. But just the other day I was on my trail bike and I still run XTR 12-speed cable drivetrain on that thing and works great. And I signed up for the 3-day this time, Breck Epic. It's a big high alpine, kind of like all day endurance mountain bike event up in Breckenridge, Colorado. And I'm just kind of getting around to figure out what I'm actually going to ride for that thing. And when it comes to drivetrain stuff, I mean, I probably could go with an electronic setup, but I kind of want to go with something that I could potentially fix when I'm out in the middle of nowhere at 12,000 feet. But anyway, I'm a little worried that a lot of the attention, particularly at the performance end of things, is going to be exclusively on electronic. And that certainly is where SRAM is going anyway. Remains to be seen where Shimano is going with that. But I will say I'm really, like we mentioned this on episode 4 weeks ago or something like that, that introduction of Shimano Qs, that lower end drivetrain. And I actually just put in my request for a test group set. I don't know when those things are going to be available, but I really want to see how that thing is, because if it is what I'm hoping it is, it ideally is just going to bring really good levels of performance at a really, really attainable price point. And that particularly for me is what I'm more excited about.
It's going to be heavy to log up Wheeler Pass though.
I didn't say I was going to use Qs at Breck Epic.
Okay.
But I do want to test. I mean, maybe I'll use it there. I don't know. But I do want to bring it in to test regardless.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's a very, very interesting new product and relevant to the vast majority of people riding bikes in the world. So
Yeah.
I agree. The general attention to electronic drivetrains is frustrating, and unfortunately it's almost necessary the way frame designs are going, which is a whole different debate, but the way the cables are now being hidden in internally and directed through handlebars, I mean, you kind of have to have electronics for a bike to function well with those systems.
You don't have to have your internal routing.
You have to.
No, sorry.
I'm not saying you have to have internal routing. I'm saying if your bike has internal routing, you then almost have to have electronic shifting to have a functioning bike.
I guess that's my point. There are ways around that. Like, we're solving problems that have been created with other problems anyway.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah. It's all a solution to new problems.
Stay tuned. I dare say I may have something in written form to say about that subject soon. So right, anyway. Right. Zach, what do you have on your mind?
It's kind of similar to you.
Oh, how so?
I recently built up myself a new XC bike.
Oh.
And I built it up with SRAM Axis Eagle stuff.
Uh-huh.
Not the latest stuff because I wanted to bike ready for the season and I wasn't planning on new group sets being released in April or whatever. And my previous XC bike had SRAM Eagle mechanical shifting, and I kind of miss it. I think the electronic stuff, there's like noticeably more hesitation when you shift.
Yep.
Like where the mechanical, you can kind of just slam it into gear and mm-hmm. like rattle off a couple shifts, where the electronic stuff, it kind of like you have to ease up pedaling just that slight amount, which I found annoying.
I find Eagle, previous Eagle, Axis would like, I wouldn't know when to time my shift. Like with mechanical,
exactly.
You can kind of time the way you're pedaling with the feel through the shifter and know exactly when that chain is going to jump to the next cog. With Eagle Axis, I was kind of always like almost guessing it, almost being surprised at when the shift actually happened.
Right. And which, which is interesting because I have the same like derailleur and cassette on my gravel bike and I don't notice it for that. But on a mountain bike where you're just like constantly accelerating, mm-hmm. going up and down little punchy climbs, like I've noticed it and I kind of miss my mechanical shifting.
Yeah. So yeah, I'd say that's one area where new transmission is better for me because it didn't have that weird lag and it's so good under power that you know if you hit the button, it's just going to get into that gear. But yeah, I mean, it's an odd one.
For me too, it's like the mechanical stuff is still lighter. So that makes me kind of want it even more.
Yeah. Yeah. Lighter, more fixable. So yeah, I mean, suddenly there's merit to high-end mechanical stuff. I mean, my own trail bike has XTR mechanical and I treated it like trash on Sunday by riding it in the rain for 6 hours and it actually functioned flawlessly. So when that stuff's set up well, it's very, very good.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not trying to be like super grumpy old mechanic in the back or whatever, but it was just a very interesting observation that because I hadn't ridden that stuff on an actual mountain bike on proper rides. And it was very mm-hmm. noticeable on the first couple rides where it's like, oh, this kind of hesitates a little bit.
Well, and even just from a cost standpoint, I mean, Dave, I know you've written obviously extensively about the new SRAM XXSL and like whatever the other two versions of their new transmission.
Yeah.
But all three versions of that are awfully expensive. And on my mm-hmm. wife's trail bike, I set her up with mechanical SRAM X01. It's great. It does work really well. And I have to say one of the first thoughts I had after seeing all the news about the new SRAM stuff, I'm honestly really curious if SRAM will come out with a direct mount sort of UDH version of their mechanical stuff.
I think you know the answer to that.
I mean, I'm guessing it has to be yes.
I'm guessing it's a no.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, there's so many rumors of coming out with Apex Axis stuff.
Oh, that's true.
Like, they're not going to all of a sudden make new mechanical
that's
stuff
true.
Around.
I mean, SRAM is all in on electronic. But I mean, I guess I'm just saying for me.
Oh, yeah, like, you would like that product.
Given the purported advantages of that style of derailleur attachment, all of those merits would carry over to a mechanical system. And it would not only make that system more durable in my point of view, but it also would make the shifting potentially better also in my point of view. So from a functional standpoint, I don't see any particular reason why it would be a bad idea to bring that over to their mechanical stuff. But I can see how from like a, I guess, marketing or business development sort of point of view that they would want to keep that exclusive to their high-end electronic stuff. If that's the case, that would bum me out a little bit.
I kind of see SRAM as almost becoming like an electronics-only company, which is...
Well, I think that's pretty clear that that's
almost,
where they're going.
Almost bizarre to consider. But yeah, it's certainly interesting. And I think that direct mount concept for mechanical may be better served by some other company. I know there's a patent floating around from TRP, for example. I know there's another one from Shimano. So I mean, other drivetrain manufacturers are absolutely looking at how to implement that UDH hanger and direct mount frame. So I think it's definitely going to be a very interesting space. I stick to what I'd previously said in my review, where that interface and the way of mounting a derailleur in that way is a game changer. And I think it will continuously become more common and eventually the standard way of mounting a derailleur.
Indeed. Well, yeah, interesting times for mountain bike drivetrains for sure. All right, Dave, we're getting a little long here. Let's move on here. What do we have left?
You've got let's wrap things up. I think you've got a PSA for everyone, James.
I do have a PSA, as a matter of fact. Yeah. It's a pretty quick one. Despite the fact that we have dumping snow outside right now, it is springtime in the Northern Hemisphere. And for a lot of people who experience actual winter, their bikes may be coming out of hibernation right now as you sort of anticipate the warmer days of spring and summer. And if you're running tubeless tires, this is your friendly reminder to check the sealant in those tubeless tires, because if it's been hanging up all winter, there's a good chance that either the sealant is dried up or it's sort of just maybe partially congealed into one spot on your tire inside. And it's a good idea to kind of just scoop all that out and replace it with fresh stuff. Because otherwise your tires won't seal, and otherwise your tires may be imbalanced, and that actually is noticeable when you're riding, particularly at higher road speeds.
I don't know why, but for some reason, the way you just described that, I could only imagine filling a bear with tubeless sealant.
Bear with tubeless sealant.
Yeah, I don't know. Just because I said the idea of a bike hibernating in winter and then awaking, and I don't know.
I mean, my bike's definitely hibernated for the winter.
Concept.
Just get hung up in November and come out in March.
And then the skis come out, and then the bikes come back out in March.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Yeah, it's just not a Southern Hemisphere thing. So,
winter is a Southern Hemisphere thing, just not where you are in the Southern Hemisphere.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I'm sure I'll get lots of people telling me they hibernate their bikes in winter. So I don't doubt it happens. I will just be quiet now.
All right. Well, that is my friendly reminder for this week's show. And with that, we'll go ahead and close out this week's episode of Geek Morning. Thanks for listening, as always. And I know that we did a big old self-promo at the beginning of this episode, but just as a reminder, Escape Collective is member funded. So if you like what you heard today, if you like what you read on the site and you want to read more, you haven't become a member yet, please consider doing so, because that is how this whole thing is funded. Like, we do work for you. So,
And if you've got feedback, become a member so you can give it to us.
Yes. And you can go ahead and yell at us personally and we will respond to you. So feel free. All right. Well, that is all we've got for you this week. Make sure you tune in next week if you are a member, and if you're thinking about being a member. Again, next week's Geek Warning episode is going to be a live recording where you'll have the ability to ask us questions in real time, and we'll get back to you in real time. Go ahead and sign in next week. But in the meantime, we will see you next time. Thanks again for listening.
Cheers.
Bye.